This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson visiting KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Authorities in Turkey might have audio and visual evidence proving that a dissident Saudi journalist was killed inside the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul. The U.S. has joined an investigation into the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S. resident and a Washington Post columnist. Also, America's ambassador to the UN announced this week that she will leave the administration at the end of the year. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo took another stab at persuading North Korea to disarm its nuclear weapons. Brazil will hold a runoff election to determine its next president. And India's Bollywood experienced its own Me Too moment and the fallout that comes with it. Joining us from our home base in Washington for the Friday News Roundup is John Sopel, North America editor for the BBC and the author of If Only They Didn't Speak English, Notes from Trump's America. John, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Also with us in D.C. is Nancy Youssef, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, welcome.
Great to be with you.
And Uri Friedman, a staff writer at The Atlantic covering global affairs. Uri, glad to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
We're also pleased to get your questions and thoughts about the week's top stories from around the world. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream, or tweet us at 1A. The U.S. representative to the U.N. is stepping down. President Trump accepted the resignation of America's ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, on Tuesday. Here is some of what she had to say during the announcement at the White House.
Look at the 2 years. Look at what has happened in 2 years with the United States on foreign policy. Now the United States is respected. Countries may not like what we do, but they respect what we do. They know that if we say we're going to do something, we follow it through. And the president proved that, whether it was with the chemical weapons in Syria, whether it's with NATO, saying that other countries have to pay their share. I mean, whether it's the trade deals, which have been amazing, they get that the president means business, and they follow through with that.
That's Nikki Haley speaking on Tuesday at the White House, announcing that she would resign as U.S. ambassador to the U.N., reportedly at the end of the year. Nancy Youssef, let me start with you. What was your read on her reputation internationally in terms of the way that she represented the U.S. to the world on a diplomatic level?
Well, I think she personified for the world community the idea of the America First sort of slogan that the Trump administration came in with. And we heard that really from the onset of her arrival there. And she was making that message to the world community daily on issues like North Korea, on the Palestinian issue. And so while Trump had sort of created the rhetoric, she created the sort of measures that sort of signaled to the world that the United States wasn't just talking rhetorically, but was acting in its sanctions policy, in its stance on issues like the Paris Peace Accord and others, that it was moving towards that direction. And I think because of her personality and the sort of the way that she sort of captured the attention at the UN and spoke so forcefully, and at the same time seemed to be a close confidant of the president, she really sort of delivered this idea to the world community of America First. And you started to see under her tenure a world community sort of adjusting on that message, and not presuming that it's just rhetoric, but actually the foundations of U.S. foreign policy under the Trump administration.
John Sopel, what's your read of Nikki Haley's reputation, particularly because at times she was a fairly fierce defender of the White House's international agenda, but at other times she was not afraid to differ?
Exactly. She was Trumpian without being Trump. And I think that the international community found her a kind of reassuring figure who could translate some of Donald Trump's impulses and urges to do things into kind of more rational, thought out argument. And for that reason, I think that they found her a figure of reassurance. I think when she was a good communicator. I mean, you know, when she took on the Russian ambassador and she had the picture of the children who had been gassed in a chemical weapons attack in Syria, I think the rest of the international community thought she was highly effective in what she was doing. And I suspect they will miss her because what you always worry is that maybe you're going to end up with somebody who is even less internationalist, less kind of globalist in the kind of UN sense of it, and therefore maybe a more difficult person to deal with.
Well, Uri Friedman, that's kind of what I wanted to ask you about, particularly the tone of Nikki Haley compared to some of America's other leaders on the world stage. I mean, you have Mike Pompeo as the Secretary of State, who's a little more hawkish than his predecessor, Rex Tillerson. You have John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, who is definitely not shy about his view of the world and what America's foreign policy should be. What's our thought, so far anyway, about who or what might be next in terms of America's presence on the UN? Would it be someone who is a little more in line with John Bolton and Mike Pompeo in terms of being more hawkish and more forward, or someone in line more like Nikki Haley?
Yeah, I would bet on someone who is more in line with Donald Trump's America First vision. We don't know that. There have been a number of names floated. One name was Dina Powell, who formerly served on his National Security Council. Now that's being batted down. And there was some criticism that she was too much of, you know, in Trump's derogatory term, a globalist. One thing that was striking about Nikki Haley, as John mentioned, sometimes she was Trumpian without being Trump. Sometimes she wasn't even Trumpian, right? She would actually be a check on the president on things like Russia, being more aggressive on Russia, talking about human rights, which almost no one else in the administration did. And one thing that I've noticed is that over time, as Donald Trump has settled into the presidency, he started to surround himself with people who will more, even if they don't believe exactly, even if they aren't true believers in his America First vision, are at least going to help enable his agenda as opposed to serving as a check or obstructing his agenda. That's what we've seen with Mike Pompeo versus Rex Tillerson. That's what we've seen with John Bolton versus H.R. McMaster. So I would assume that who may follow Nikki Haley will be someone who is more of a true believer, or at least more willing to enable the agenda rather than stand up to the president. And that will have implications for U.S. policy at the United Nations.
And Uri, since that term gets thrown around so much, and it's not always meant as a compliment, when we say someone is a globalist, what are we talking about with that term? Like, what's the code underlying that?
Yeah, the idea, you know, the way Trump supporters use it in a derogatory fashion is that people are concerned about global interests and forgetting about the primacy of the national interests. They're, you know, what Donald Trump often says is he wants to stop looking out for the world and start looking out for America. And then the feeling is that if you're a globalist, you don't have America's national sovereignty, national interests in mind. But, you know, defenders of that would say America is the leader of the world. We are trying to help create an international system in which, you know, human rights are championed and there's stability and we prevent conflict and all of these things. And we have to think that in our current 21st century world, things like climate change are not just, you know, an issue for the United States. They're an issue for the world. There are transnational issues that everyone needs to care about. And we have to have a more internationalist mindset and a mindset of working with other countries in order to solve problems that don't just affect us, but affect all lots of other countries. So that is the pro-globalist mindset. But it has really become a word term that has been more tarnished in the Trump administration, as people have argued that we've spent too much time being international minded and not enough time being national minded.
We're speaking to Uri Friedman, who covers global affairs for The Atlantic, John Sopel, North America editor for the BBC, and Nancy Youssef, who covers national security for The Wall Street Journal. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this or any of the top stories around the world that caught your eye. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. One big story that has captivated the world's attention this week has to do with a respected Saudi Arabian journalist. He recently became a critic of the Saudi regime, and he disappeared inside his country's consulate in Turkey. Turkish officials have spoken of murder, maybe dismemberment, at the hands of Saudi agents. His name is Jamal Khashoggi. Nancy Youssef, give us a sense of who Jamal Khashoggi is and why he was seen as a threat or a thorn in the side of the Saudi regime.
So Jamal Khashoggi was a longtime journalist and covered Saudi issues. Before that, he was actually a royal advisor to the Saudi regime. He has been a journalist since the 1980s. He interviewed bin Laden. He also came from one of the more prominent Saudi families. And so he was really a national figure and arguably a regional one. He had nearly 2 million followers on Twitter. And so he was probably one of the most prominent names in journalism. And what was interesting about him is he really tried to walk this threat, a very thin line, where he sort of called for reforms in Saudi Arabia, but also called for inclusions of groups that they consider an existential threat to them, like the Muslim Brotherhood. And so over the years, particularly post-Arab Spring, when these issues had become so polarizing, he came under increased attack by the regime, some of whom sort of were taken aback that someone who had once been in their circle was now criticizing him. And in the last year, he went on a self-imposed exile here in Washington and started writing columns for the Washington Post. He had two audiences, the Saudis, Saudi people, and the Americans. And he was really trying to be a voice for reforms in the Middle East against these sort of decade-long rules that he saw as sort of undermining progress in the region. And so he was a very well-known figure in Washington. He was a known figure in the region, and controversial, maybe not simply because of what he wrote, but because of the impact of his writings across the region at a time when it's so divisive about whether one can support outside groups in regimes that feel deeply threatened by the threat of another Arab Spring-like uprising.
Yeah, and I do want to talk more about the relationship, particularly between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, as we continue with John Sopel, Nancy Youssef, and Uri Friedman. Chess1643 wrote on our website, the1a.org, there is no reason to maintain close ties with a country that beheads more people than ISIS, finally gives women the right to drive, but it's only window dressing, is killing civilians in Yemen, and murdered a journalist who is critical of the royal family, and royal is in quotation marks. If I were king for a day, all the weapons we've sold them would be rendered useless, and Jared Kushner would be banned from any policymaking. Quite a bit to pick apart and fact check. We'll get to that in just a moment when we continue. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you from San Francisco. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Uri Friedman of The Atlantic, John Sopel of the BBC, and Nancy Youssef of The Wall Street Journal. We'd love to hear from you, too, your questions about the U.S. and North Korea, the election in Brazil, Interpol's missing president, or any of the international stories that caught your eye this week. Comment on our Facebook page, where you can watch our video stream. Tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let's get back to that story of the Saudi Arabia journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who has gone missing, possibly murdered. John Sopel, we've heard a number of accounts, particularly from the Turks, about what Saudi Arabia allegedly did to Mr. Khashoggi, that they basically sent hitmen after him. What do we know for sure about the disappearance at this point?
For sure, we know that he walked into the consul in Istanbul and he didn't walk out. That is what we know for sure. There are then reports that there were two Gulfstream jets that came from Saudi Arabia with 15 men. They got into blacked out vans, drove to the consul general's residence, which is allegedly where Khashoggi may have been taken. And they did what they did to him. Now, there are reports circulating that Turkish intelligence have proof that they know what happened to him and that he was tortured and dismembered and met the most brutal of brutal deaths, and that the 15 men then flew back to Saudi Arabia on their Gulfstream jets a little later in the day. Now, we know that the planes, there were those two plane movements at different times that came into Istanbul airport and then went back to Riyadh. Who was on them? What their designation was within the state apparatus, we don't 100% know. But you get the distinct sense that that what the Turkish are telling the authorities here and what the authorities here in the US understand is not a million miles from what I have just sketched out. Because I think that there has been a willingness to believe, and that is why you're seeing the deep expressions of anxiety and unease over what has unfolded and over what the implications might be. There are some things that you can easily sweep under the carpet in international affairs, and there are some things that are just a bit more awkward, and this definitely falls into the latter category.
Uri, I wonder if we could talk about the U.S. and Saudi Arabia's relationship. They're very long-time allies. At a press conference at the Oval Office yesterday, President Trump was asked about Khashoggi's disappearance. Here's part of what the president said.
First, I want to find out what happened, and we're looking. Again, this took place in Turkey. And to the best of our knowledge, Khashoggi is not a United States citizen. Is that right? Or is that right? He's a permanent resident. Okay. We don't like it, John. We don't like it. And we don't like it even a little bit. But as to whether or not we should stop $110 billion from being spent in this country, knowing they have four or five alternatives, two very good alternatives, that would not be acceptable to me. Okay, but we're looking for the answer, and I think probably you'll have an answer sooner than people think.
The president speaking at the Oval Office yesterday, and when he was referring to they, he meant Saudi Arabia, and the four or five alternatives would be other countries from whom the Saudis could buy arms. The $110 billion is an arms deal, a military deal between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Uri, I wonder if you could give us your sense of how this case fits into the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, especially in light of the comment that I read earlier. I'll reread it. Chess1643 wrote on our website, the1a.org, "There is no reason to maintain close ties with a country that beheads more people than ISIS, finally gives women the right to drive, but it's only window dressing, is killing civilians in Yemen, and murdered a journalist who was critical of the quote-unquote royal family. If I were king for a day, all the weapons we've sold them would be rendered useless, and Jared Kushner would be banned from any policymaking." Lot of sharp elbows thrown in that comment. I wonder if you could help us fact check that.
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating point. And also that clip you played of Donald Trump was really striking, because on the one hand, it seemed so coldly transactional, in the sense that he was saying, you know, we have billions of dollars pouring in. Why am I going to stop that just because they have murdered a dissident journalist? In other words, I don't care about human rights, something we usually stand up for. I care about money pouring into the United States economy. And that attitude has activated a lot of people in Washington who are against our alliance with Saudi Arabia. For example, senators on both sides of the aisle, like Chris Murphy and Rand Paul, who've been arguing for a long time, just as the commenter said, that we are supporting a war in Yemen that is unconscionable, that is starving civilians and killing civilians in, you know, bus attacks and other things that are just horrendous.
Sorry to cut you short, but since you mentioned Rand Paul, I'm really sorry to interrupt you, but we have a clip of Rand Paul speaking to a reporter this week on that very thing. He said he would try to force a vote on U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia. I'll let you finish your thought, but first let's hear from Senator Paul.
I think that the early reports have shown that this is linked to the Saudi government, and nothing happens in Saudi Arabia without the government's approval. So no, I think that unless all of a sudden the journalist turns up alive, I think that we should discontinue our arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Plus, I think we need to be voting in the Senate and debating whether or not we should be involved in the war in Yemen.
That was Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. Uri, go ahead.
So I was going to say, people like Rand Paul are going to push back against arms sales, about our support for the war in Yemen. You even saw lawmakers invoking the Global Magnitsky Act, which says that the U.S. Trump administration has to investigate what happened, and if they find Saudi officials responsible, they need to impose sanctions. All that being said, there's a counterpoint to this, too, which is that our relationship with Saudi Arabia has always been transactional. Trump kind of said the quiet part out loud a little bit in the way he framed it yesterday, because we have never had a relationship and alliance based on values. Since World War II, it has all been about money and oil. Think about 9/11. 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. That didn't lead to a permanent rupture in our alliance, because we have always seen them as a strategic ally, not as a values-based ally as in Europe. And I think that's important to keep in mind, that Trump said it in a particularly accentuated way, and he feels, you know, is very transactional way past presidents have. But this is somewhat reflective of what U.S. Presidents have said quietly for a long time.
Yeah, Joshua, if I could chip in there, that's exactly mm-hmm. it. I mean, I think Donald Trump said out loud what other presidents and other prime ministers have said at awkward moments in relationships you have with regimes that are far from perfect. I mean, I remember when Tony Blair was prime minister, and there was a huge arms deal that was about to be concluded, and the British Serious Fraud Office launched an investigation into what Saudi Arabia had been doing, and whether they'd been paying kickbacks or whatever to get contracts through. And you know, it was clear that the Saudis had said to Blair, "You've got to call off the dogs, otherwise the deal is in jeopardy." And highly unusually, massively controversially, Tony Blair intervened with an independent investigation and said, "Right, we're cancelling this investigation." investigation. And he used his power as prime minister because he felt he had to, because Saudi Arabia was too big a customer, too important an ally. And you've seen with Donald Trump, you know, one of the first places he went to when he became president was to Saudi Arabia. I traveled with him on that trip, and it was, they were 100% in with Mohammed bin Salman. Now, whether they're regretting that or not is an open question. However, they are there, and they, and Donald Trump is determined that the arms deal will go ahead.
Joshua,
before we keep moving, go ahead, Nancy.
I was just going to say, if I could just add, one thing that struck me is what the president didn't say. He didn't mention Iran, and he didn't mention the peace deal. And as you recall, last month at the UN, the United States was pretty aggressive in calling Iran the biggest threat to the region. And by extension, it was seeing Saudi Arabia as that stopgap against possible Iranian expansion across the Middle East. And of course, Saudi Arabia would be key to any sort of peace deal. So I think it's interesting that a month ago we were talking about policies and going against Iran. And so going forward, how much will the U.S. focus on Iran and stopping an Iranian expansion shape its reaction or lack thereof to what's happened in Saudi Arabia, and if it in fact is the case that they have killed a journalist inside their consulate who was a resident of the United States?
Speaking of journalists who have been killed, there's another journalist being remembered today in Bulgaria at a funeral. The body of 30-year-old TV host Victoria Marinova was found over the weekend near the Danube River in a northern Bulgarian town. She had been raped and strangled. Uri, apparently German authorities have arrested a suspect in this case. Do we know anything more about it, particularly whether her death was connected to her reporting?
Yeah, there's kind of a battle of interpretation over that. So the Bulgarian authorities are saying, no, it wasn't. This was a spontaneous act by someone they say was wanted for another rape and murder. So this is someone with a criminal background. There are others, though, who argue that one, the authorities were too quick to say this wasn't a contract killing before knowing all the facts, which raises suspicions. And then two, I think people are just really primed at the moment to see things as retaliation against journalists because we're in a very bad climate for journalists right now. And actually, in Marinova's final broadcast, she had interviewed two investigative journalists who were looking at government corruption. And so that raises questions, too. So we don't know. And even if it was, not related at all to her work, it's important to know that there are reasons atmospherically for this suspicion. You know, Bulgaria is ranked 111th in press freedom in the world, the lowest for any EU member state. So this is a country where there is not a lot of press freedom, where in broader, if you zoom out from Bulgaria, in Europe and around the world, where press and the journalists are under attack, whether it's calling fake news or actually intimidating journalists and trying to suppress the free press as countries become more authoritarian. So I think that this is representative of that, whether or not she was targeted specifically for the work she had done on corruption.
And John, we should also note that in other news about media, there is a blogger turned investigator who seems to be going head to head with British intelligence in sussing out facts about the poisoning attack on Sergei Skripal, that former Russian spy, and his daughter. Can you tell us briefly, John, about this guy, Elliot Higgins, and what he says he discovered about the suspects?
Well, it has been the most extraordinary research that has been done. I don't know whether it's going head to head. It's kind of complementing the work of the British security services. And I think they're sitting back and kind of rubbing their hands with some glee at the discomfort that the Russian Secret Service, the GRU, is being put through over this. Because, you know, we know that there was a chemical weapon attack on two people living in Salisbury in Wiltshire, about kind of 80 or 90 miles southwest of London. And they used Novichok, a nerve agent, to try to kill these two people. Someone else subsequently died from it, but not those two. And there was an investigation, and the police kind of did the most amazing job with CCTV cameras, of which there are very many in the UK. And they charted these guys that when they arrived from Moscow, their journey down to Salisbury, the wrecking of everything, and then going back again. But this Bellingcat website has identified them through a mixture of getting access to kind of insurance details of the cars that they insured and all the rest of them. But we now have a full identity of the two people. I think the important point to make here, Joshua, is do we think that this was just utterly stupid spycraft on the part of these Russians and that they are kind of comedy caper idiots who didn't know what they were doing, or do the Russians not care? Is this a message that you send out to would-be double agents around the world? We will come after you and we will give you the most painful death imaginable.
I'm Joshua Johnson and you're listening to 1A. A number of stories out of Asia this week. Let's start with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and his tour of Asia. The secretary made a number of stops, including a lunch meeting with Kim Jong-un on Sunday in Pyongyang, North Korea. President Trump tweeted about that meeting, writing, quote, "At Sec Pompeo, had a good meeting with Chairman Kim today in Pyongyang." He also wrote, "Progress made on Singapore summit agreements. I look forward to seeing Chairman Kim again in the near future." Nancy, Secretary Pompeo also reported positive steps forward being set from this visit. One of the big items would be that North Korea said it would allow international inspectors into a missile testing facility. Where does this latest meeting place us in terms of the effort to denuclearize North Korea?
Well, it's unclear. Those inspectors, we don't know who those inspectors would be and where they would be from. There are two sites that the North Koreans have repeatedly made reference to, a nuclear test site and a missile test site that they are prepared to destroy, that they destroyed tunnels in the former and the launch pad for the latter. And so one could interpret that the North Koreans are really trying to get as much mileage out of their decision to do that without having to make any more concessions as they seek another summit with the president, because from their perspective, that summit builds on its nation's legitimacy. And so we heard a lot of talk about progress, but none of those key questions have been answered. Who would do those inspections? When are we going to get an inventory of their nuclear program and compare it essentially with the U.S. one? What would sort of a peace declaration for the end of the war look like and at what cost? And so we're at, one could argue, at the stasis where one can't agree. There's an agreement that things need to be forward, but the specifics that actually get you towards progress, such that the U.S. feels that it is getting something for what it's done so far, beyond the North Korean promise to destroy these sites and let some unnamed inspectors see it.
The U.S. has also been putting some pressure on an increasingly tense relationship with China. Department of Justice officials said on Wednesday that a Chinese spy was arrested and extradited to the U.S. to face charges. This will be the very first time that a Chinese intelligence official will be prosecuted and tried in open court. U.S. lawmakers are also weighing in to add pressure on China regarding human rights abuses. The Congressional Executive Commission on China put out its annual rights report. It unveiled a bill to condemn the treatment of Uyghur immigrants in China. Uri Friedman, I wonder whether these two efforts, the extradition of the Chinese spy and calling out China for its treatment of Uyghur immigrants, what that amounts to.
Yeah, I think they're related in the sense that the Trump administration is really launching a broad challenge to China at the moment on every front. I mean, whether it's a multi-billion-dollar trade war or cracking down on spycraft, you know, this isn't the only case. Yes, it's the first case in the U.S. where the Chinese intelligence official will face open trial, but this is not going to be the only case in which they are doing that. Many suspects remain at large. And then also you saw last week Mike Pence, the vice president, give a speech, and basically he, like, threw down the gauntlet. He said, you know, this is a great power rivalry. And I was struck by something that John Bolton, Donald Trump's national security advisor, said right before the United Nations General Assembly, when he said, "I don't think people understand what's at stake here. This isn't about, like, getting a better trade deficit terms with China and addressing the trade deficit. This is about power. China's economic power, whether they're stealing our trade secrets or importing more than, exporting more than importing, when they get more economic power, they get more military power. And this is really about a rising China and a ruling United States confronting each other in a way that might have happened under Hillary Clinton or anyone else, but is particularly acute at the moment between Xi Jinping, who is being much more assertive on the world stage, and Donald Trump, who has said for a long time he's not going to tolerate this anymore, that we have built up China at America's expense. And so I think whether it's through the, you know, lens of human rights or through the lens of cracking down on Chinese tradecraft, we're saying no more. We're not going to tolerate this anymore.
Much more to discuss as we continue the Friday News Roundup with Uri Friedman of The Atlantic, the BBC's John Sopel, and Nancy Youssef of The Wall Street Journal. We'll talk a bit more about the U.S. relationship with China. Indeed, another big story out of China has to do with the story of ex-president of Interpol, Meng Hongwei, who was reported missing last week by his wife. We'll also talk about Brazil's election, and Melania Trump made some news this week. We'll get to that in a moment. Stay close. back now to the Friday News Roundup with John Sopel, Nancy Youssef, and Uri Friedman. Still time to get in some of your questions and thoughts about the week's top stories as well. 1A@WAMU.org. The story of the ex-president of Interpol, Meng Hongwei, who was reported missing last week by his wife, that story is moved. Meng was detained by Chinese authorities on corruption charges. He resigned in immediate effect this week. The arrest is part of a larger official anti-corruption campaign by China's President Xi Jinping. Now, Grace Meng, the ex-Interpol president's wife, is speaking out. She told the Associated Press that she felt threatened. Nancy Youssef, do we have a sense that, you know, of why this is going on, of what it is that makes Meng so important to the Chinese government, or what this means in a larger sense?
Well, he's been a long-time operative of the Chinese government, and there are arguments being made that this is part of an effort to purge non-loyalists to the Xi government. And so there's no definitive answer, but I think the message that many are taking is if somebody who's been in government this long in a police capacity could be swept off the streets, and his wife sent a knife emoji the day he disappears, that no one in China is safe. And at the time of all this, there was talk from party officials about the importance of absolute loyalty. So their suggestion certainly is that somehow he was less than loyal in the eyes of the government. I will say, I think one of the more interesting developments as well is his wife and how outspoken she has been. She has been, she's in French protective custody, but she's been speaking out in a way that we wouldn't normally see out of China. And I thought it was an interesting development and may have led to more information coming out quicker than Chinese officials wanted to happen. And so it was fascinating to watch her sort of use the public platform in a way we'd see more often in the West as a way to get information about her husband and defend her husband. It's something we don't normally see.
Let's head now to Brazil, where far-right presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro surprised the nation when he shot to the top of the ranks. He nearly took the election with 46% of the vote, just shy of preventing a runoff. Brazilians will vote in their runoff election soon, on October 28th. Uri Friedman, can you remind us who Jair Bolsonaro is and what makes him and his policy platform so newsworthy?
Yeah, he's a fascinating character. He's a former army captain. He's been in Congress for almost 3 decades. He is a law and order candidate. That is his big thing. So he says, you know, our crime rates are too high. We need to empower the police. He is very controversial in saying, you know, the police need to shoot first and shoot to kill, and also to loosen gun laws to address crime rates. He's also very controversial in the sense that he said things that are misogynistic, that are anti-LGBT. And one other thing that's really important is, so Brazil, we often forget, only became a democracy in 1985, or returned to democracy in 1985. For 21 years, it had a dictatorship, and he has spoken nostalgically about the time of the dictatorship as a time when there was law and order. One other point to note is that he is enamored with Donald Trump. A lot of conservatives feel that Donald Trump has the right formula: be pro-business, you know, loosen regulations, you know, be nationalistic, and be about cracking down on crime. And he has promised to be a really close ally of the United States. All of this is very shocking because Brazil, for many for decades, has been led by a leftist government that was a little more ambivalent about its relationship with the United States, and certainly didn't espouse kind of the right-wing views that he espouses. So this was a real shock to the system. I think it really goes to the fact that Brazil, I mean, it's in deep recession. It's embroiled in a massive corruption crisis that affected all parties except for Bolsonaro, who has actually not been implicated in this. And that was his winning point. And I'll say one other thing. We, you know, The Atlantic read an article in which they interviewed a cab driver who said, you know, things are so bad, maybe we need someone with crazy ideas. Who else is going to fix this mess? And so I think that is a sentiment that is worth keeping an eye on, because that was a similar sentiment in Brexit, in Donald Trump's victory, in the victory of Andrés Manuel López Obrador in Mexico. I mean, this is a sentiment that people are feeling against the establishment right in many countries of the world.
Glad to hear from some Brazilians who are listening in today and looking ahead to the election. One listener emailed, "I'm Anna, a Brazilian listening from a city next to Brazil's capital, Brasilia. I'm very concerned about the future of our democracy. The candidate leading the polls is an ex-military who has a very anti-democratic discourse, which is also racist, misogynist, and homophobic. Since last Sunday, the election day, more than 50 people have suffered physical and verbal aggressions from Bolsonaro supporters. Social media, specifically WhatsApp is playing a very important role and lots of fake news is circulating. I really believe that with Bolsonaro, our democracy is at risk. John Sopel, what's projected to happen for the runoff? Is there any sense of whether Bolsonaro could win this?
Well, the last poll I saw suggested, yes, that the latest poll suggests that he is at 58% and the opposition leader is at 42%, Fernando Haddad. And so I kind of think that you'd have to say that it's with that sort of margin of error, it's going to take something for the leftist kind of candidate to come back from that position. I mean, you know, they talk about violence. And the other thing about Bolsonaro is that he was stabbed in September at a rally. So there's been a lot of violence all round, but it has meant that he has been able to say, I'd love to take part in debates, but I really can't at the moment because I'm still, you know, slightly getting over the stabbing that I had then. So I'm afraid I won't be able to come to your studio this evening. And so I think that there is kind of a feeling that, you know, he's got his head down. He has said what he has said. People know exactly where he stands. And I think he sees the finish line.
One story that much of the world has been talking about has to do with a new report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. The report says that the world is quickly running out of time to stem catastrophic climate change. Scientists predict we are on course to go beyond a crucial threshold of the world's average temperature rising 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit in just over about 10 years. They say that would leave us dealing with the risks of extreme drought, wildfires, floods, food shortages for hundreds of millions of people. We talked about this report on the program this week. One comment from a listener stuck along the lines that at least here in America, this is just not a big enough issue. I mean, people vote for a lot of reasons, and the state of our climate is not something that lawmakers talk much about or that voters demand to discuss. Nancy Youssef, what is your sense of that, of whether or not this report has made an impact around the world enough for people to start demanding action?
I think it's made an impact, but the problem is the effects of this are already being seen in various ways around the world. So where one country could say it's not a big impact, another country could see it as an immediate impact and something that needs to be dealt with aggressively. And of course, the kinds of changes that this report says need to happen are so drastic that it demands sort of a uniform world agreed upon action, and we're not there yet. And so you're seeing a variance in response, and I think it really reflects the variance of impact that nations are already seeing. And you know, as a war correspondent, one of the things I see it come up most often is as a cause of the start of wars and conflicts, environmental changes, changing where people live, how they're able to eat. So it's an area that doesn't just hit the environment, but really hits other parts of national security and government writ large. But there's, because of the complexity in terms of its impact, I think it's hard to get a uniform agreement, particularly in such a polarized time. So it's hard to be optimistic that we'll see, at least in the short term, the kinds of drastic changes that this report says needs to happen to stop literally famine, drought, wildfires, really severe consequences.
Joshua, I was in Europe at the beginning of the week, and when the report came out, and our main national news shows, kind of half an hour long, so the same as the nightly news programs here, the first 6-7 minutes were devoted to this IPCC report. I wonder how much was devoted. I mean, that's one of the things that really strikes me about living here compared in America, where you get more weather, I think, per square inch than any other kind of country on the planet. You talk a huge amount about weather, but climate is not discussed. And that is one of the things that really strikes me. Whereas I think in Europe, there's a much greater consciousness. Whether they're doing that much about it is another issue. But I think that, you know, I am struck by how little this commands the national debate compared to in other parts of the world.
And Joshua, I just add one thing to that. I spoke with the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, recently, right before the UN General Assembly. And I asked him, what is the greatest threat you face right now? What is your greatest challenge? I expected him to say avoiding a disruption with the United States or the conflict in Syria. He said climate change. He said, this is the existential question of our time. This is what I'm focusing my most energy on. Conflicts you can try to solve, you can always solve. If we don't stop this in the next few years, it becomes irreversible damage. And that is what he's devoting most of his attention to. You know, I thought he is one of the people I thought of this report as almost the UN standing at an intersection and gesturing wildly to go in one direction. And the world in a convoy of cars is zooming 70 miles per hour in the other direction. You know, we are moving not in the direction of what this report recommends. And they are saying we need to take action immediately.
Yeah, the reaction from some international lawmakers has been pretty muted. This is environmental campaigner George Monbiot. He gave his take on why politicians seem reluctant to speak out on this.
You know, they just want the issue to go away so people stop talking about it. That's all they want, because it just messes up everything. You know, all their nice cozy relationships with corporations, all their five-year plans, everything just goes by the wayside because it does just question all the premises on which our politics and economics has been created.
That's environmental campaigner George Monbiot. Would be worth noting that we did have a longer conversation about this report earlier in the week. You'll find that on our website, the1a.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. It is the world's biggest film industry. It makes millions of dollars, many millions of dollars, but Bollywood has stayed pretty much silent on the Me Too movement until now. This week, Tanushree Dutta went public and filed a police complaint against a film star named Narna Partika. Dutta says he insisted that intimate dance steps were included in a song for a movie they were working together on. The former Miss India Universe told the BBC it was, quote, really creepy because he had to put his hands all over me, unquote. She says she was labeled unprofessional and called a crazy drama queen. Narna Partika denies the allegations. I wonder, Nancy, what's our take on this? The Me Too movement not only reaching Hollywood, but also Bollywood.
It was striking to me reading the developments in the last few weeks, how universal the questions are that are around this across cultures in terms of what constitutes sexual harassment, what constitutes sexual assault, what is appropriate, what isn't appropriate, and what repercussions, what are sort of the mechanisms in terms of determining what should happen should someone violate someone in this way. And there was just such a universality in the language and the questions that were coming out of India. And the other interesting thing to me is that this was started by one actress bringing a complaint, and all of a sudden it opened the floodgates for other people coming forward, much like this country. So it was, to me, a real eye-opener in terms of how this issue isn't defined so much by country or culture, but by a shared experience across the world. And for me, this was a real eye-opener about to that point.
Let's get to a little reporting from the BBC from this year in Mumbai. Reporter Rajini Viyad Anarthan did speak to several Bollywood actresses about Me Too. Here's how one woman described her experience with a film director.
He just said bluntly, okay, see, I like you, you know that, but I need this sexual relation with you. And I said, no, that you are saying no, then I'm not going to cast you in my film. And on the top of that, he cursed me. She said, no, you're not going to get any good roles and nothing good will happen to you and this and that. And I was like, I don't think you have that much power.
We should note, by the way, they're talking about very, very big celebrities that might not be household names in the U.S., but big Bollywood stars that are known to millions. John Sopel, before we move on from this, what do you think might have changed that's now given Indian women in Bollywood more confidence to speak out?
Hashtag Me Too. I mean, the hashtag Me Too has become a global phenomenon, and it doesn't matter which part of the planet you're on, people are aware of it, and people are thinking that it is my time now to speak out. And, you know, and you can see it in corporations, in organizations up across the world where the Me Too movement is having an impact. It's having an impact on the way people feel they can behave in offices and with their fellow work colleagues. And it seems to be universal, maybe slightly less so in kind of parts of this administration where it still seems that, you know, somehow you are disbelieved and, you know, you can be trashed if you come forward to make a complaint. Not referencing any, of course, any appointment to the Supreme Court recently.
Two more stories that caught our attention before we go. When the First Lady of the United States is a former model, it's not unusual for the world to pay very close attention to her fashion choices. But Melania Trump drew more criticism for her travel wardrobe. In June, she took a trip to the U.S.-Mexico border wearing a jacket that said, "I don't really care, do you?" That was at the start of the current family separation crisis that left many children unaccompanied and detained by the nation's immigration process. This week, Mrs. Trump got criticism for what she wore while visiting Africa on her first solo trip abroad. The main outfit that got mocked online was an off-white pantsuit with a matching fedora. It drew comparisons to everyone from the Woody Allen character in Annie Hall to Michael Jackson in the video for Smooth Criminal to that evil Nazi in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Also, another story that caught our attention before we go, the British sci-fi mainstay Doctor Who debuted its 30th Doctor this week, and for the first time, the Doctor is a woman. Actress Jodie Whittaker took up the sonic screwdriver after Peter Capaldi left last year. In the world of the show, every time Doctor Who dies, he, or now she, is regenerated into a new body. The decision to have a female Doctor was met with some shock and rage in some corners of the web, but to mark the occasion, Mattel released a Doctor Who Barbie doll this week. Before we go, John Sopel, you work for the BBC, so you are required to answer the question about Doctor Who. I think this is cool. I think it's a great change.
I tell you what, as I said to you, Joshua, I was in London earlier on in Europe in the week, and on Monday, I bumped into the controller of BBC One, which is our main national channel. It had got 8.7 million viewers in the UK. Now, we're a small island, and in an era where kind of people have got many different ways of watching, that is a phenomenal audience for Doctor Who out of a population of 60 million. So she was delighted that Doctor Who, as a woman, was doing as well as she was. And I think that they kind of think that this regeneration lark is going well so far. So, I mean, enormous interest. It's one of the great brands that the BBC has. I sound like I'm doing an advert for the BBC, which, of course, I'm not. But it's one of the great brands that the BBC has around the world. And they were pretty chuffed about it all.
John Sopel, North America editor for... What's chuffed?
Happy,
right?
Happy.
Okay, all right. I learn something new every... John Sopel, North America editor for the BBC, Nancy Youssef, national security reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and Uri Friedman, staff writer at The Atlantic. Nancy, John, Uri, thanks very much for talking to us. 1A senior team is Daniel Knight, Denise Couture, and Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Gabe Bullard. You can learn more about them online at the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Absolutely chuffed to have you listening. This is 1A.